slide there that there's not a children's class today, and there will not be one next week either. So give you kids practice sitting still. I forgot to adjust my mic before we started church, so it may take us a minute or two here to get situated. I want to begin by showing you a presidential campaign button that I ran across a year or two ago, and it goes something like this. You see that? How many of you see the humor in that? Anybody? Two or three? Four? Okay. Let me educate the rest of you then. In 1972, who can tell me who the presidential candidates were on the Republican ticket? 1972. Does anyone know? Nixon. His running mate was Agnew. Spiro Agnew. On the Democratic side, who were the presidential candidates on the Democratic ticket? McGovern was the president, and for vice president was Sergeant Shriver. Is that the right name there, Don? Okay, here's the catch, though. Prior to Shriver being the vice presidential candidate, McGovern earlier had a man named Eagleton. And was his name Thomas? Thomas Eagleton was his vice presidential candidate. And Chester, y'all got to hear a hum here, kind of an echo or something. Might need to turn. Now it's gone. There you go. But anyway, it came out during the presidential campaign that Eagleton had been treated with some type of mental problems. It may have been as minor as depression, but there are some mental questions surrounding Eagleton, and as a result of that, he dropped out of the race, and McGovern chose a different candidate. Well, Nixon won the election, and between 72 and the election of 76, if you remember, Agnew was convicted. Is convicted the right word, or just accused? I think he was convicted of tax evasion, I believe it was, and he had to resign as Vice President of the United States. So in 76, someone humorously comes up with this presidential campaign button. Let's have Agnew and Eagleton for president in 76. Hey, nobody's perfect, right? Okay? And thinking of that, and I'm not thinking of the Eagleton in what I'm fixing to say, so let's forget Eagleton. Just go with Agnew here. Convicted of tax evasion, a man who is given placed in a position of responsibility, and yet we find this glaring error, fault within him. And, you know, I could have this morning made a list just off the top of my head of a number of people in public places or in private life that I have known, and you could make most of us would have people on the same list of people who have been given much responsibility, and yet in some way fail to use that responsibility wisely and correctly. And I want to talk to you this morning about, you see the title of the message, Living Low in High Places. People who find themselves in a high position of authority, and yet their lifestyle doesn't quite match up to that. We're going to read our text in Acts chapter 15, the first 12 verses. I want to back up and give you a recount of what's going on prior to this. You remember Paul had made it back to Jerusalem. This is way back two or three chapters ago. And he goes into the temple to demonstrate to the Jews that he has not forsaken the law. He's not forsaken his Jewish religion. And while he's there, some people from Asia who recognize him create a stink and stir up the crowd and the mob into a angry riot, and they're trying to actually take Paul's life. They want to kill him. And the scene is so violent that the Roman soldiers have to come in and rescue Paul from being killed by his own Jewish brothers. He is questioned before the local Roman authorities there, and they decide that they'll get the truth out of him by beating him. So they tie him up, and as they're about to whip him, Paul asks them, he says, is it lawful for you to do this to a Roman citizen? And they immediately back up a little bit and go and get their authority, the captain there, and find out that Paul is indeed a Roman citizen, and they apologize to him and let him set him free. Now, they don't actually set him free, they just untie him and refrain from beating him. They try then to have a reasonable discussion between Paul and the Jewish leaders, but there again it almost ends in violence. And so they take Paul away to safety there in Jerusalem. They get word that there are some men who have taken a vow upon themselves that they will neither eat nor drink until Paul is dead. They are serious about assassinating Paul. Now, word gets to the Roman government there that this is underway, and they take a huge force of several hundred soldiers and whisk Paul out of Jerusalem to safety and carry him to Caesarea. Now, we don't hear what happened to these men who take this vow upon themselves. Either they starve to death, or perhaps they fell before God and said, "Lord God, what a stupid fool I've been to make such a vow." Or perhaps, as is most often the case, at least in my life, God graciously overlooks their stupidity and refrains from giving them the justice that they deserve. At any means, Paul is in Caesarea. He appears before Felix. Now, Felix, it's interesting, the historians tell us something about Felix. Felix did not have a glamorous background. Felix was not raised in nobility. Felix actually was a slave, or had been a slave. And yet he was a slave apparently in Caesar's court and pandered himself to the depravities of the emperor to such an extent that he was granted favor and favor and favor and favor until he is freed and raises to the position of governor in this area of Judea. Now, that's interesting. But Felix is in Caesarea. He is the governor there. And that's where they carry Paul to appear before Felix. The Jewish leaders are to appear as well. They are the accusers. And they bring with them this sharp-talking lawyer. And the lawyer is there before Felix, and the Jews despise Felix. They hate him. Do you know how hard it is to despise someone but act like that you like them? Do you know how hard it is to despise someone but tell them how wonderful they are? Now, Felix is no fool. He knows these Jews do not like him. And so they have this sharp-talking lawyer with him. And this lawyer comes to Felix and says, "Oh, most noble Felix," and starts building him up. And you can almost see the lawyer under his breath saying, you know, just hating to do this. And Felix is sitting there thinking, yeah. You know, I'm sure this is real sincere. Let's wait, get to the point, see what this guy's wanting. He presents his case to Felix as to why Felix ought to have Paul killed. Paul gives his defense, and Felix decides to wait until Lysias comes to town and to get a little more information, he says, before he can make a decision. He waits 2 years. That's a long wait, isn't it? We're going to come back to some details there. But in the meantime, and this is something that history tells us as well, that we don't see here in this text, Felix and his degradations and his depravity and his self-centered rule has become so bad during this time that Caesar, the emperor, recalls him and replaces him with a man named Festus. Now that's where we're going to take up. The last verse of chapter 24 says this: "But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room." That means he took his place. Felix is gone elsewhere. "And Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound." So when Felix departs, he leaves Paul in prison. Now, chapter 25. "Now when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem." Now, Festus is moving fast. He is acquainting himself with the area in which he's going to rule in a big hurry. He comes to Caesarea, that's where his headquarters are. He stays there 3 days and immediately goes to Jerusalem, where the hub of activity is, to kind of acclimate himself to his surroundings. "Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul and besought him." So he gets to Jerusalem, and the high priest and the Jewish people there immediately seek him out. It's been 2 years since they have Paul, or Paul's been locked up, and they have still not forgotten. The passion with which they want to have Paul put to death has not slackened at all, it doesn't seem like. Now in verse 3, "desired favor against him," against Paul, "that he would send for him to Jerusalem, lying wait in the way to kill him." So they want Festus and ask Festus, "Will you bring Paul here so that we may try him?" But all the while they're planning on ambushing him and killing him on his trip back. "But Festus answered," verse 4, "that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly thither. Let them therefore," said he, "which among you are able, go down with me and accuse this man, if there be any wickedness in him." And when he had tarried another among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought. And when he was come, the Jews which had came down from Jerusalem stood round about and laid many and grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. While he answered for himself," and this is Paul's answer to their charges, "neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar have I offended anything at all. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, 'Will you go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me?' Then said Paul, 'I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar.' Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, 'Hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Unto Caesar shalt thou go.'" Now, I want us to look at this morning. I've given you a sentence there in the introduction that we're going to base some things off of. And it says this: even though responsibility often carries authority with it, authority is not always carried out responsibly. Now let's say that again. Even though responsibility often carries authority with it, authority is not always carried out responsibly. Now, in this text, the authority and the responsibility that we're looking at is in high places. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can sit here this morning and say, "Well, this doesn't apply to me. I'm not a king. I'm not a governor. I'm not a ruler in high places. I'm just me." But it will apply, because we're going to take some principles from three or four things here, and the principles will apply. Now, I'll give you a little application test here. This is how you'll tell if what I want to say this morning can apply to you. Okay, everyone, hold up your hand about 2 inches in front of your mouth. Now take a deep breath in. Now let it out. Did you feel your breath on your hand? If you did, this will apply to you. Okay? If you didn't, we'll call the coroner. All right? I want to look at three groups of people or three persons that are in high places that have responsibility and show you from each of them a pitfall that they fell into, and we'll take a principle from that pitfall that you can apply to your life. And I'll show you how perhaps I'll have applied it to mine or has applied to mine. The first one, the Jewish leaders, and I'm calling this a bully pulpit. A bully pulpit. The Jewish leaders had a responsibility. These Pharisees, Sadducees, the Sanhedrin that are coming down, they have the responsibility of leading the Jewish nation, not just in civil affairs, but in religious affairs, in spiritual affairs. In fact, those two things are not separated like they are in our culture today. They are intertwined. And they are the leaders. They have the responsibility to govern and to lead their nation righteously. And yet we find them using it, a bully pulpit, to carry out their own agenda. Now I want to give you a sentence here. It says this: it is irresponsible to use illegitimate means. Everybody know how to spell illegitimate? Michael, you want to spell that for us? Don't ask me how to spell it. You ought to know how. Looking up in the dictionary or something. It's irresponsible to use illegitimate means to accomplish a desired end, even if the desired end is right. Now let's assume for a minute that the Jews' theology was right. Let's assume for a minute that Paul the Apostle was a troublemaker. Let's assume for a minute that he had desecrated the temple. Let's assume for a minute that the Jewish leaders' motives were right. It is still irresponsible of them, being in the position they are in, to use the means they are using to get what they would declare to be right to be done. And yet, it's easy for a person with responsibility, for a person with authority, to take that authority and push it down someone's throat because they have the power to do so. Let me bring that home to you. I have seen mothers. I'm not talking about governors. I'm not talking about presidents. I'm talking about parents run their children ragged because they were too lazy to do something for themselves, because they were too sorry to do something for themselves, because they were too drunk to do something for themselves. Children, 8, 10, 12 years old, raising their younger siblings because their parents are using a bully pulpit of being bigger than them, stronger than them, and running over them. Irresponsible. Let me show you how that works, or has worked in my life. God, in His sovereign grace, let me stumble upon a wife who was opposite of me in so many ways. And our personalities are so different. And I'm going to exaggerate our personalities to some measure so you can see the point I'm making. But my personality is such that let me illustrate it by something that happened to me. Years ago, I went into McDonald's one day, and there was this lady in there that was our a friend of mine, Susan. She was in there with her young children and her sister's young children. Her sister had two or three young daughters. And the oldest of the daughters was about 3 or 4 years old. She wasn't so big that she was standing up in the back, in a chair at McDonald's, and it didn't seem out of place. You know, she was young enough that didn't seem wrong. But I was, you know, talking to these little girls and kind of joking with them and stuff. And I told this one girl, I said, "You ought to go home with me. I got two bad boys you could play with." And Mark and Dan were about that age too. And she was standing up in the chair, loud voice, said, "Bad boys go to hell." And I'm, you know, hide, man. But, you know, my personality, in a way, is similar to that. Let me give you an example. And I'm going to, like I say, exaggerate this a little bit. Sometimes, you know, people will lie to you. And there have been times that someone has, told me a lie, and I know it's a lie. And you know what my tendency is to do? Is to say, "You're lying. That's a lie." When somebody lies to Susan, and we're both standing here, and somebody tells us a lie, you know, I want to scream and shout it. "You're lying." You know what she wants to do? "Well, how nice." Totally different. And, you know, over the course of our marriage, and as I say, I'm exaggerating, though, just a little bit. But over the course of our marriage, some of the little spats that we have had, some of the little disagreements we have had, have been because I have not learned not to use my position as a husband and as a defender of the truth to run roughshod over somebody that I think might be lying. Or anything else I think just might be wrong. That's irresponsible. Even if I were right. That's the first thing. These Jewish leaders have an agenda. Their agenda is to defend Judaism. Paul is a threat to that. And they are doing whatever it takes, using the authority that they have, whatever it takes to run roughshod over whoever is in their way to take his life. Perhaps their error is greater than our own, but we can still err in that regard. The second person we're going to look at is Felix. Now here's the statement there with Felix. "Why can't I have my cake and eat it too?" We all heard that saying before. "Why can't I have my cake and eat it too?" Now what happens to Felix? Paul is brought before Felix. And Felix is torn between two or three things. First of all, Felix wants to please the Jews. The text tells us he wants to show the Jews a favor. So he wishes, on the one hand, that he could do what the Jews are wanting him to do. But on the other hand, Felix knows something. Let me show you two or three verses here that tell us a little bit about Felix. Look in verse 22. This will be Acts chapter 24. Verse 22, "And when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them." Now what does this say? Felix listens to the Jews. Felix listens to Paul. But it gives us one little phrase that tells us something about Felix, and that Felix is not ignorant of this new Christian sect. Felix knows a little more about it than perhaps they'd think. You can see another hint of information there about in verse 24, after certain days when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess. Felix's wife was a Jew. It is not unreasonable to think that perhaps Felix has talked to his wife about her background, about Judaism. It's not unreasonable to think that perhaps Felix has talked to his wife about Paul and about this new sect, and whether it is or is not a part and portion of Judaism. So Felix knows these things. Look in verse 25. And as he reasoned, now let's go to verse 24, finish reading 24. He sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. And as he reasoned, as Paul reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled and answered, "Go thy way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee." Felix defers to the Jews. He puts them off because he wants to please them. And on the other hand, he knows that that is not right. So he has Paul put in prison. And the text also tells us it wasn't just prison, but he left Paul with his liberty. He said, make sure that he can come and go. He's just like under house arrest. He can't leave town. Anybody that wants to come visit him, any of his friends, let them come. Sounds like our jails, doesn't it? But he's still here. And occasionally, Felix would call for Paul. And Paul had the opportunity, perhaps first at Felix's invitation, to discuss these things with Felix. And Felix apparently sees enough of the truth and is convinced enough of the truth that he doesn't want to hear it anymore. And he finally says, "Paul, I'm busy. You got to go. We'll get together again later. I got things I got to do." But we find out one more little piece of information that Felix is struggling with. He wishes that Paul would bribe him. He wishes that Paul would offer him money, and then he'd let him go free. So notice all of these things that's going on in Felix's mind. He wants to please the Jews who want to kill Paul. He knows they don't have a case. He knows Paul, if he did what was right, he would let Paul go. He's tormented inside by this knowledge of what is right. But at the same time, he's weak enough and he's fleshly enough. If Paul would offer him a sufficient amount of money to set him free, he'd take it. That's a sorry individual, isn't it? He's wanting to have his cake, but he's wanting to eat it too. Felix has got a problem. And for 2 years, he leaves Paul in this situation, hanging like this. Now, here's the sentence there. It is irresponsible to allow your fleshly desires to keep you from doing what responsibility demands. Listen to those words. It's irresponsible to allow your fleshly desires to keep you from doing what responsibility demands that you do. Now, I want to illustrate that in this way. We've got some young babies here. Floyd's, my grandson, Anthony back there, probably some others that I'm not seeing at the moment. But those babies have a slave. The younger they are, the more acute they have the slave. And that slave is their mother. That mother is available at their every beck and call. They can have their cake and they can eat it too. But as they get older, and I'm going to use a boy in this illustration, but it could in a similar way, could be a girl. As they get older, they begin to realize a little more or at least they ought to, that I can't just do everything I want to do. Just not allowed. And when a boy gets 12 or 13 or 14 years of age, he sits down at the table at night and he says something like this: "Mom, could you pass the butter?" His voice starts changing. Just as quickly, he can sound like a five-year-old, and the next syllable, he can sound like a grown man. And in a similar way, so can their actions. One time, you can look at a 13-year-old boy, and he's acting like he's 18 years old. The next day, he's playing cops and robbers out in the field with a toy gun. And you think, golly, what's going on here? And then they get a little bit older, and this scenario comes to pass. The child, the boy, he wants to do something. Why can't I go do this? And there comes this debate between being responsible. You're not responsible enough. And the child responds with, "Well, you just don't trust me." We heard that scenario before. It's as old as sin. In fact, sin is usually right in the middle there somewhere. Okay? And I want to tell you, if you're 13 to 20, I want to tell you how to get your parents to let you do whatever it is you want to do. Okay? All you parents, turn your hearing aids down, okay? This is for the kids. I'm going to tell you how it is that you can get your parents to let you do whatever you want to do. I'm not serious. I'm not kidding. This will work. Okay, before I do, I'm going to ask you a couple questions just to learn a little bit about you. If you are, do you ever take out the garbage at home? Typically the answer is, when my mom asked me to, I sure do. Do you ever make up your bed at home? Sure, when they tell me to, I make up my bed. You ever mow the yard? When my dad tells me to mow the yard, I mow the yard. That sounds like a real responsible person, doesn't it? Everything he's told to do, he does it. Sounds good. Now, let me put on my Columbo routine for just a minute. There's just one thing that bothers me about this. Could I ask you a personal question? Now, here's the personal question. Does your grandmother live with you? Somebody's paying attention, aren't they? Does your mom's parents live with you? No. Does your dad's parents live with you? No. Now, here's my problem. You do these things when your mom and dad tells you to. How do they know when to do it? How does your mom know when the trash needs taken out? Who tells her? So here's the answer. Here's how you can get your parents to let you do whatever you want to do. You do these things before they tell you. Okay? You're going to have to do it anyway. Why not? You know? Take the trash out without being told. Make your bed every day. Mow the yard when you come home without anybody telling you to do it. After supper, tell your mom, say, "Mom, go sit down. I'll wash the dishes. I'll take care of it." Okay? Now, here's what the kids are thinking right now. Is this the work, though? So here's their question. How long am I going to have to do that? Now, I want to show you how to get the answer to that. You go home tonight, and when you see your mother putting clothes in the washer, or maybe you see her washing dishes, walk up there to the sink where she's washing dishes and say, "Mom, you've been washing dishes week after week. How many weeks are you going to be doing this?" What's the answer to that? As long as you dirty the dishes. So here's the answer. How long are you going to have to mow the yard? As long as the grass is growing. How long are you going to have to make your bed? As long as you're sleeping in it. How long you got to wash dishes? As long as you're using them. Here's the point. There comes a point in your life where you're going to have to do this for the rest of your life. Now, if you want your parents to let you do whatever it is you want to do, you get that mindset. You get big enough and old enough that you drive a little bit and have a job, call home one day on your way home and say, "Mom, I'm on my way home. Just want to know if you need anything from the store." And she can say, "Oh, get me a loaf of bread." "Oh, don't worry, Mom, I've got money." Mom. Right? You do this consistently. With the attitude, this is the way it's going to be for the rest of my life. I guarantee you, the day will come when your parents will let you do whatever it is you want to do in 10 or 15 years. Okay? Responsibility. Being torn. Being torn between wanting to be free, wanting to be to be treated like a grown-up, and yet at the same time having a slave, a parent for a slave. That's where Festus was. Festus wanted two things, and he couldn't have them both. You know, sometimes that's the way it is with us. No, I want this, but I also want that. And I make decisions based upon my desires rather than based upon what responsibility I have, what that demands from me. That's just part of being grown. Thirdly, go from Felix to Festus. Festus got a hot potato. You ever played hot potato? Different versions of the game, but some of them have this potato that has some little spring-loaded device in it, and after a certain amount of time, it pops open, you know. And so you're sitting around, and you're getting rid of that potato because you don't want to be holding it when the thing blows up. Well, that's the position that Festus is in here. Festus is the new kid on the block. He comes to town, and he's got one of the same problems that Felix had. He wants to please the Jews. But Festus is a little different than Felix. First of all, he gets things done. Seems like he's a mover. He gets decisions made. He's not content to let Paul sit there another 2 years while this thing is floating around. But on the other hand, Festus doesn't want to be the one that has to decide all this stuff. So how does he handle it? He's at Jerusalem when he first hears about Paul. And the Jewish leaders there come to him and say, "Listen, you've got this guy Paul up in Caesarea that ought to have been put to death 2 years ago, and Felix wouldn't do it. We'd like to ask you to bring him back here so he can be on trial and justice may be done." And Festus gives what looks like a good answer. He says, "Listen, he's there. That's where he ought to be tried. If you want to come up there, come with me. I'll be leaving in a few days. We'll go and I'll hear your case when I get there." So that's what he does. But all the time, you still see this little phrase, willing to show the Jews a favor, desiring to please the Jews. So he gets there. And he hears the story, and he knows the arguments, and he knows what is right. But he asks Paul, Now notice what he's trying to do here. He's trying to let Paul make the decision about whether to go back to Jerusalem. Paul, are you willing to go back to Jerusalem and be tried before me there? Now why is he doing that? Because he doesn't want to be the one to do something wrong. If he carries him back to Jerusalem and the courts there are influenced in such a way that Jerusalem, Paul cannot get a fair shake, and Paul ends up being put to death, Festus can say, hey, he's the one that wanted to come here. Maybe Festus knows about this plan to ambush him. Doesn't say that he did. But if he does, maybe he's thinking to himself, well, if we go back and he's killed on the way, he's the one that wanted to go. Trying to let Paul make the decision. He doesn't want this hot potato to be caught in his hands when it goes off. Here's the principle. It's irresponsible to skirt around a decision until circumstances make it for you. And I'll tell you, this is more common than you might would think. Fathers, preparing your children to be adults. I'll tell you one of the situations that I had that was hard to know what to do. Most of you know we homeschooled our kids, kindergarten through 12th grade. By the time Mark and Daniel were about out of school, I had, to some degree, taught them what I thought they ought to know about life, about the birds and the bees, or whatever you want to call it. And we had had discussions along those lines. But I'll tell you one thing that I had not done. When you are in some other environment besides homeschooling, you're liable to hear little catchphrases that are vulgar, that are inappropriate, that are degrading. Hear all kinds of things. And I assume that my boys grew up not knowing some of those things. Not knowing what this little word might mean, the kids commonly use. And one of the things that I ask myself at times, how much of that should I tell them? Should I warn them about this nasty word? You may hear this someday. This is what it means. About this vulgar thing, this is what this means. You may hear it someday. I didn't do it. Well, the day came, Mark's fixed to leave for boot camp. Y'all know what boot camp's like? I don't, but I can imagine. And I remember telling Mark, there are lots of things you've been shielded from. There are lots of words, lots of sayings that probably you haven't heard that you're going to hear. I don't know what they are. And when I was in school, they were, and I didn't tell him the words, they were one thing. Probably nowadays it's something totally different. But I just want to warn you, be careful. Be careful. You may find yourself embarrassing yourself with your ignorance. You may find yourself sticking your foot in your mouth because you don't know any different. Now, if we were to raise the question, should I have prepared him better? it was too late. Now, I'm not saying I should have. I don't think so. But I'm just saying you can put off a decision. And you can put it off, and you can put it off until it's made for you. You can do that with morality. You can put off and put off training your daughters until they're grown. You can skirt around these hard issues that are difficult to deal with until they're made for you. You can do it in business. A business opportunity may come, and you may pray about it and pray about it till kingdom come. And the day may come when the opportunity is no longer available and you haven't made a decision. There are many women, Christian women, who are extremely frustrated in their home because of fathers and husbands who behave just like this. They half-hearted lead their family. They put things off. They relegate things that they ought to be doing to the preacher or to mama or to somebody else. And a lot of Christian women are wishing, longing for a husband that would take the bull by the horns and lead his family. That's where Festus is at. Festus is not wanting to decide this. He's wanting Paul to do it. Paul, take this monkey off my back. You tell me what to do. How do you want to handle it? Now let's look at Paul. Paul is in a situation that people ought not to ever be in. Now I want you to look at the question that Festus asked Paul in verse 9. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, and here's Festus' question to Paul. And I want you to think of how Paul is going to answer this. He's got to answer it. He doesn't have 3 days to think about it. He says, Paul, would you be willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial at Jerusalem? Now notice what Paul says. First of all, he says this, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat. And that's right here, right where he's at right then. I'm standing in Caesar's judgment seat right now where I ought to be judged. So Paul tells him the truth. Here is what ought to be happening. I'm where I ought to be. But you know what? That's not one of Paul's options. Sometimes doing right isn't an option. Now that's hard to swallow. I noticed you noticed what Paul's options are. Apparently, Paul, unless Festus himself decides, but Paul can either go to Jerusalem, where he will not get a fair shake if he even makes it there. And he knows that. He says, I'm where I ought to be. And if I have committed some crime worthy to be death, then put me to death. I don't refuse to die. But if I have not done anything, if the accusations are against me are false, then here I stand. I appeal to Caesar. Now notice Paul, I think, is pretty crafty right here. Because he allows Festus to do what Festus is wanting to do. Festus is not wanting to decide. And Paul gives him a way out. Here's another option, Festus, where you can not do anything. Send me to Caesar. Let Caesar deal with me. So that's what happens. In your life, in my life, there are a ton of decisions and a ton of things that you have to decide in life, taking into account the irresponsibility of somebody else. It ought not to be that way, but that's the way it is. My wife has to make decisions in life based upon, to some extent, my own weaknesses and my own sin. I'll just tell you two or three things. They're right at the bottom of the page here. Remember, whatever the situation you may find yourself in, it may be a minor thing compared to what we've read right here, but remember this, God is still sovereignly in control of everything, even over other people's irresponsibility. God is still in control. God's hands are not tied just because someone is acting unrighteously. Second thing is, do right. Just do right. Third thing, pay the price. Whatever price you have to pay for doing what is right, pay it. Be willing to pay it. Let's pray. Lord God, Father, I know my own tendencies. I know my own weaknesses. I know those things in my life that I deceive myself with. Father, would you help us? Would you help me? Lord, to behave responsibly as a father, as a husband, as a grandfather. In my vocation, as a leader in this church, as one of your children, as a child of the King, Lord, help me behave like what I am. Lord, would you give us grace? Would you give us understanding? Would you give us humility to recognize where we are at? Change our hearts. Amen.